Good evening. I'm Amna Nawaz. Judy Woodruff is away. On the NewsHour tonight, California burning. Record-breaking temperatures complicate efforts to control multiple fires across the state. Then, the testing problem, how the COVID-19 testing system in the U.S. continues to fall short, and how to fix it.
We can't even test people to make sure that the sick people are getting tested in a consistent, timely, and easy way. And that's the dysfunction of our health system and our implementation system.
And a house divided. Why two generations in the same family are split over politics. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. California tonight is home to a record-shattering heat wave and about two dozen wildfires currently burning across the state. Nearly 15,000 firefighters are battling steep terrain and tinder-dry conditions as they fight to control the raging infernos. This afternoon, the U.S. Forest Service announced it will temporarily close national forests in the southern and central regions of the state because of the fire risk.
More than 2 million acres already scorched this year in California. Record-breaking swaths of land burning under record-breaking temperatures. Governor Gavin Newsom last night declared a state of emergency in five counties as some 20 fire conglomerates smolder across the state. The largest fire alone, Fresno's Creek Fire, has burned over 73,000 acres. A caravan of Labor Day weekend campers were surrounded by flames and forced to flee to a nearby lake. Sisters Caitlin and Mackenzie Meek escaped the fire's path.
1 minute you're just sitting at camp, and then the next you're driving through flames trying to save everything.
Backpacker Juliana Park documented her drive out of Sierra National Forest, the road lined with flames.
Getting rescued right now.
Rescue teams deployed to Fresno have already airlifted out more than 200 trapped campers.
The crews were absolutely ecstatic when they came off the helicopters.
Colonel David Hall of the California Army National Guard.
All of the individuals that they rescued were greeting the crew members with hugs as they were boarding onto the helicopter, and then again after getting off the helicopter, a lot of high fives.
Several fires still burn completely uncontained, and state excessive heat warnings are in effect until tonight. Officials warn the worst may be yet to come.
Temperatures in Los Angeles County reached a record high of 121 degrees yesterday. While it's cooler there today, temperatures inland are expected to top 100 degrees. For a closer look at what's behind that heat wave and what's fueling these fires, I'm joined by Leah Stokes. She's a professor and researcher on climate, energy, and political policy at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She joins us this holiday from Ontario, Canada. Leah Stokes, welcome to the NewsHour. Let's start with that warning. Why is it that authorities believe that this fire season could get even worse soon?
Well, unfortunately, climate change is happening right now in California, and we've been lengthening the fire season quite considerably as we warm up the planet. In California, our fire season is now 2.5 months longer than it used to be, which means that people are at risk all the time. And as you mentioned, we're seeing record heat waves, not just in Los Angeles County, but also in Santa Barbara County, San Luis Obispo County, and all of that heat is really increasing risk for fires.
Now, you mentioned climate change, of course. How do we know that that connection is there? Because we should mention some of the activities that spark the fires are, in fact, just related to human behavior. There was one fire started by a gender reveal party in which someone used a smoke machine that sparked a fire. So explain that connection to us.
Yes, it is true, of course, that we make decisions in our daily lives, such as the people who decided to have that gender reveal party. But, you know, it becomes so much more risky to actually have that spark light a fire under climate change. So we know because of research from scientists that we have 500% more risk for wildfires during this climate-changed world than we would have before. And that's because it's really hot and dry, because we have had droughts. And of course, that drought, which is caused by climate change, has led to a lot of vegetation dying, meaning there's a lot of brush lying around that can easily light up. And a little spark from a gender reveal party or whatever it is can end up being a massive inferno very quickly. So of course, people need to be careful and be held accountable when they light fires. But the fact is, climate change is the real culprit behind what we're seeing right now.
We should mention, too, California's fire record goes back to 1932, but the 10 biggest fires on record there have all happened after 2000. Should we expect that trend to continue?
Unfortunately, we should. You know, I've only lived in California for 5 years, and I've already been evacuated from my home for weeks on end. And what scientists are telling us is that we are entering a period of mega fires where the scale of burning is just beyond what we've seen before. So as you mentioned, we're seeing really large fires. And there isn't any reason to believe that that will stop because we are not taking the climate crisis seriously, and we are not reducing fossil fuel emissions around the world. So California really is a canary in the coal mine here, and we need to be waking up. And just as the bird was dying from coal, we too are dying from burning coal, oil, and fossil gas.
We should mention also we are mid-fire season now. Are there steps that residents or local authorities or state authorities can be taking to mitigate damage for the rest of the season and prepare for next year?
Absolutely. You know, our firefighters and our cities are doing the best that they can. They do all kinds of things, like suggest that residents make small retrofits to their home that can dramatically reduce fire risk. They do things like create fuel breaks, which sometimes are controversial for good reason. So people are trying. But, you know, the really big solution here is taking on the climate crisis. And that means that we need new leadership, particularly in Washington. We need somebody who actually believes that climate change is real. And unfortunately, we don't have that right now.
That is Leah Stokes from the University of California, Santa Barbara, joining us tonight. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
In the day's other news, hopes are fading for another round of pandemic relief funding as Congress returns to work tomorrow. President Trump today accused Democratic leadership of not wanting to make a deal and said he would not meet with them. Meanwhile, in Geneva, the World Health Organization warned against governments politicizing the virus.
If communities perceive that they're getting information that is being politically manipulated or that is being managed in a way that is distorting evidence, then unfortunately that comes back to roost. That comes back at a government politically at a later stage. I think that has been the case around the world.
Also today, India surpassed Brazil to become the country with the second highest number of coronavirus cases in the world, more than 4.2 million. The U.S. still leads the worldwide count with more than 6 million confirmed infections. In Saudi Arabia, 8 people were sentenced to prison for their roles in the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. 3 were given sentences between 7 and 10 years. 5 were sentenced to 20 years after Khashoggi's family agreed to spare them from execution. Khashoggi was killed in 2018 at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. A United Nations investigator criticized the trial, which did not find any senior Saudi officials guilty. In Belarus, 2 members of an opposition council calling for a transfer of power have gone missing, as well as a leading opposition activist. Maria Kolesnikova was reportedly kidnapped off the street in Minsk by masked individuals and driven away in a minibus. Their colleagues fear it's part of a government crackdown after weeks of protests, including a massive rally on Sunday in the capital, all in response to last month's disputed election. Doctors in Germany today said Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has been taken out of an induced coma and is now responsive. He fell ill last month after being poisoned and was airlifted to a hospital in Berlin. German authorities said he tested positive for the Soviet-era nerve agent Novichok. Russia has denied any involvement. And the U.S. Navy continued to search today for an American sailor who went missing from one of its aircraft carriers. The USS Nimitz was patrolling the Northern Arabian Sea Sunday evening when crew members sounded a man overboard alert after being unable to find the sailor aboard. The sailor has yet to be identified. Still to come on the News Hour, how the patchwork of COVID-19 testing in the U.S. continues to fall short. The race for the White House hits the final phase after Labor Day. A grandfather and grandson on different sides of the political divide, plus much more. We'll be right back.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As the summer comes to a close and fall begins, experts worry flu season could further complicate the pandemic response. In the U.S. today, there are about 830 COVID-19 deaths per day and nearly 20,000 more cases per day than when the Memorial Day weekend started. Since then, the overall death toll has grown by nearly 90,000. Now, testing has improved, but problems with access and delays continue. Dr. Atul Gawande of Brigham and Women's Hospital examines our country's testing system in his new piece for The New Yorker, and he offers a plan for how he says it can be fixed. Dr. Gawande, welcome back to the NewsHour. You deliver a message a lot of people want to hear right now, which is that we can control the pandemic soon, before the flu season, if we want to, and it will take a nationwide commitment, you say, and you focus in on one thing called assurance testing. You say that is crucial to making this happen. What is assurance testing?
Well, what it is the kind of testing that you see that the NBA is doing. It's being able to screen people to say, are you safe to work with in environments where we can't wear our masks, we can't socially distance? Assurance testing is testing to assure that we can live together and work together. And that's going to be an important part of what we have to be able to do.
So it's really regular, much more widespread testing than we have right now, because right now the process is you make an appointment, sometimes you wait days for that, you maybe have to pay the provider, you wait days for the results. There's problems at each step along the way I want to ask you about. Let's start with how we're testing, and right now there is sort of a patchwork of testing technology. There's the nasal swabs we have all seen, there's antigen tests, there's these at-home test collection kits hitting the market now. Is that patchwork going to work if we're going to get our arms around this very soon, as you say we can?
Well, what is cool is that American innovation is bringing a whole emporium of different kinds of capabilities to the table. And we have a lot of laboratory capacity that has grown up, but so much of it is untapped. It's not being delivered to the places that we need. So I think the technology is great, but we don't have a technology problem. We have an implementation problem. I name a number of labs that would double the amount of capacity we have today for just making sure that, you know, forget being able to test whether everybody is safe for working together. We can't even test people to make sure that the sick people are getting tested in a consistent, timely, and easy way. And that's the dysfunction of our health system and our implementation system. We can, there is enough capacity. We can bring it to the people who need it, and we can make it work. But it depends on understanding that this is the problem we have to tackle. And then we have to want to, we need our leaders to want to take that on.
You mentioned the labs, the processing of those tests. That is a major choke point in the process right now. There's basically four big commercial labs that kind of dominate all of this: Quest Diagnostics, LabCorp, BioReference Laboratories, and Sonic Healthcare. You mentioned there are a bunch of available labs that aren't brought online as part of this process. How does that happen?
The majority of U.S. testing is by a very small number of labs that have not just the laboratory capacity, they have the logistics. They can do the billing in our crazy system that has different people paying for, you know, this insurer and that insurer, or Medicaid paying for each part of it. They can do the, make sure that there's the right barcodes on the samples. They have the software systems. But there are dozens, really hundreds of labs that have capacity that would be willing to bring that to bear. You know, think about it. Korea, in the first week of approving capacity for labs, had 47 labs online. We have three or four national labs that are the dominant source of U.S. testing, when we actually have scores to hundreds that are ready to bring that capacity forward. And the problem is that, again, it's not technology. You have to make sure that all of the connection points are there. It's basic public health. Match the need to the capacity that's there and create the interlinks between them. We've had a few places that have done that. For the most part, though, we've not taken that on nationally.
You mentioned insurance, which has also been a major source of confusion for a lot of Americans, because most people aren't clear on whether or not they should be paying or have to pay to get tested in the first place. Without completely revamping the insurance system, how does that part of this get solved quickly?
Well, I'll point to the example of San Francisco. San Francisco was one of the first hit, and then they stood up a rapid testing capacity. They opened 9 sites that were ones where the city would pay for it. They didn't try to do all the complex and very expensive billing process. They negotiated lower prices. They made sure that they were able to get great service, and they got, you know, turnaround times that were on average overnight results back. And the result was that 2/3 of all the testing in the city ended up coming through this public option. And it's been a key to the fact that San Francisco has had some of the lowest rates of transmission across the United States and consistently have been able to keep it that way.
Dr. Kawande, I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, the message is one a lot of people need to hear, that there is a way to get our arms around this and not have the flu season make the pandemic even worse for millions of Americans. But you mentioned the leadership, that it will take the kind of national leadership to pull this off that we haven't seen so far in the pandemic. So is there a way this plan gets put into place in the absence of federal leadership?
It is very hard, but I am encouraged by things like there's a compact of 10 states that have committed to work together to access low-cost rapid tests and buy together, work together, basically, you know, a confederation of states to make sure that they're serving the common interest. That's what the federal government is here for. But in the absence of that leadership, they're building those connections so that this fall they're not trying to outbid one another for ventilators and tests and masks, et cetera, but instead are working together to make it happen. And I hope that we are able to get all of the states working together to join that kind of confederation. It's what the national government needs to be doing.
It's a message I think a lot of people would welcome right now. That is Dr. Atul Gawande from Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Today marks the final sprint in the race for the White House. The presidential and vice presidential nominees were all out and about on this Labor Day holiday. William Brangham reports.
It's perhaps the most normal campaigning that this unconventional election has seen so far. Both parties' candidates made public pitches today, mixing Labor Day messages with talk of the pandemic and of race and policing. Joe Biden was in Pennsylvania for a backyard stop with local labor leaders. Later, he was asked about the development of a coronavirus vaccine, which the president has said might be ready for use as soon as next month.
One of the problems is the way he's playing with policy. He said so many things that aren't true. I'm worried if we do have a really good vaccine, people are going to be reluctant to take it. And so he's undermining public confidence.
At a White House event today, President Trump called Joe Biden, quote, a stupid person, and separately criticized those vaccine doubts, saying the Democrats were anti-science and misguided.
We are an absolute leader in every way. Under my leadership, we'll produce a vaccine in record time.
The president also again denied reports from last week that he denigrated dead and wounded members of the military.
I'm not saying the military is in love with me. The soldiers are. The top people in the Pentagon probably aren't, because they want to do nothing but fight wars so that all of those wonderful companies that make the bombs and make the planes and make everything else stay happy.
Meanwhile, the two vice presidential nominees spent today in Wisconsin. In the city of La Crosse, Vice President Mike Pence stressed the Republican ticket's support for law enforcement.
I promise you, we will always stand with those who serve on the thin blue line of law enforcement. We're not going to defund the police, not now, not ever.
In Milwaukee, Senator Kamala Harris met in private today with the family of Jacob Blake, the young black man shot in the back 7 times by police in Kenosha 2 weeks ago. She followed that with 2 other stops, including a roundtable with black business owners.
One of the attributes of healthy communities is that there is access to capital for the small businesses that are the heartbeat of those communities.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
Well, Labor Day marks the traditional start of the presidential campaign's final stretch, but one family in a battleground county has been paying close attention for a while. Ohio residents Fred Harris and his grandson Darius Harris first spoke 10 months ago with Steve Goldblum, the creator of the Brief But Spectacular series. Here now is his conversation with them about how they're viewing this critical choice.
I'm sitting next to my grandfather, Frederick Harris.
I'm sitting next to my dear grandson, Darius Harris. I grew up in the 50s and 60s. We fought the Civil Rights Movement, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, the Deep South. When I was a little boy, 8, 9, 10 years old, when we would go downtown and my mother wanted to use the bathroom, she had to go downstairs in the courthouse in a dungeon in the basement. And I couldn't understand why can't my mother use the bathroom? See, these are the kind of things that made me angry. And when I did go into the military and I had time to spend in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia, I seen a different type of racism. And that racism was right in your face. I seen people get beat. I seen them get dog sicked on them. And I said, why? I was angry. I was embarrassed. I was hurt. And I still carry that hurt with me today because I'll never forget it.
It definitely does make me angry that the world was actually like that at a point in time. I couldn't imagine living like that. I would be angry every day.
That anger and that hurt never goes away, and that'll be with me for the rest of my life. The people are angry. They're tired of the Democrats, and they're tired of the Republicans. I tell people all the time, you had the Democratic Party over here, you had the Republican Party over here, and you had the people in the middle. Politics needs to be given back to the people, not these parties. And that's what happened here in Trumbull County. That's why a traditionally Democratic county went for Donald Trump. The key to the Democratic Party in the state of Ohio is the black vote in the unions. Don't take our vote for granted. Let them win it without us. That's the power of the black vote.
My first vote actually was President Obama. Back in 2012, I was just graduating high school. I felt proud when Obama got elected because he actually gave me hope that actually a black man could actually get that high up. I kind of don't see that happening for another 100 years.
This is where we disagree a little bit. It can happen if you make it happen. It's called leadership. You have to step forward. You know, my grandson tells me, he's not interested in politics. And I explained to him, everything that takes place in the United States of America is under a politician.
Since 2012, every single politician basically, yeah, they say one thing and we're waiting.
See, this is where we disagree. I hear what you're saying. So you know what you do? You go out and you make them change.
The current president, I mean, he's, the way he acts is nuts, but But me personally, I like the way he acts because it's like he's not afraid. I feel he's the best candidate because to me, the Democratic Party, they don't have anybody in my eyes really that's gonna really push anybody.
He doesn't understand the effect that the stuff that comes out of his mouth. And if we're not careful, he's gonna destroy the United States of America. I think we got a political turmoil now, and I think history will look back on us in this time and say, wow, what happened? What do I derive most praise from? Debating. I hate to say it, but I like to debate. Well, I like to talk to people like my grandson and them, and I like to go back and forth.
My name is Darius Harris.
My name is Fred Harris.
And this is our brief but spectacular take
on the old and the new.
Well, since the world has changed dramatically in the 10 months since that conversation, Steve Goldblum recently followed up with Fred and Darius to see if their politics have shifted.
Fred and Darius, thank you both so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, it's hard to believe that it's been 10 months since we last spoke. It feels like it's been longer than that. And I wanted to follow up with you, starting with you, Darius. Has your perspective on President Trump changed since we last talked?
Back then, he was he was fine. But during the whole pandemic and how everything's been unfolding, I kind of don't agree with the way how he's proceeding with things.
Darius, I just want to be clear. Are you planning on voting for President Trump this November?
No, sir. Right now, I don't see anybody that I would vote for.
What was it about President Trump's behavior in the past 10 months that pushed you away from him?
I disagree with basically 85, 95, pretty much 100% of everything that he's been doing.
What do you make of President Trump referring to Black Lives Matter as a symbol of hate?
Well, to me, he just doesn't understand. Does he don't understand the real meaning of what it is, the whole movement, what it's about?
Mr. Harris, in the video we just played, you describe brutal images of violence where police sicked dogs on Black people. Since the killing of George Floyd, President Trump has said that he would sick the most vicious dogs on protesters. How does that kind of language and imagery today make you feel?
He's just mouthing off of the public. He thinks it'll get him votes. He doesn't understand the impact that that has on people's life, and it's dividing the country.
Mr. Harris, you described the Black vote as being crucial in winning the state of Ohio for the presidential election. Vice President Biden was not the Democratic nominee when we last spoke. He is today. How do you feel about his chances of winning in your state?
The reason why Donald Trump outpolled Hillary 4 years ago is because she could not turn out the Black vote. Not that Biden is going to turn the Black vote out, because he's not that great neither. What's going to turn the Black vote out is Donald Trump.
Darius, how do you feel about Vice President Biden as a candidate?
Me personally, I don't like Joe Biden as a candidate. Or he did all right as vice president, but to me, Joe Biden really isn't on my list.
Vice President Biden announced that Senator Kamala Harris would be his running mate. She's a woman of color. How do you feel about her addition to the ticket?
I feel like he's just doing that to get the vote.
Mr. Harris?
That will rally the Black people like you've never seen in the United States of America to vote. And the Republicans, there's no way they can suppress that Black vote. It's history. No different than when Barack Obama was elected.
Okay, well, I recognize that you two have different opinions on this, but one thing that does come through is the overwhelming respect and warmth that you two have for each other as family. So we appreciate that, and we appreciate you taking time for us today. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having us.
And you can find all of our brief but spectacular stories online. That's at pbs.org/newshour/brief. And that brings us to Politics Monday with Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report and host of Public Radio's Politics with Amy Walter, and Tamara Keith of NPR. She also co-hosts the NPR Politics podcast. Welcome to you both, and thanks for being with us on this Labor Day. Guys, we just heard from that one family in the Midwest. We heard William report earlier that both campaigns were in other states, but in the Midwest, focusing some of their messaging. Tam, let me start with you. Tell us about that messaging. In this final stretch leading up to the election, what are you taking away? What's standing out to you about how the campaigns are messaging to those crucial voters right now?
One thing that really stood out from today, as was evident in William's report, was about the virus and the vaccine. In a way, President Trump has tried to keep the focus on law enforcement issues. But today he put a real focus on the vaccine, said, as he has many times before, that he thought there could be a vaccine right before the election. He also said that there could be great economic numbers right before the election. Former Vice President Biden has accused him of politicizing the vaccine, and then President Trump accused former Vice President Biden of politicizing the vaccine. I think that this is something that we are going to want to keep an eye on as this develops. Science and vaccine development isn't necessarily the kind of thing that you want to hang your campaign on. And it's also not the kind of thing that really benefits from being involved with politics, because convincing the public that a vaccine is safe and effective is not something that in a polarized society is going to be particularly easy if the messenger is someone who's running for president or is president.
Amy, tell us about the voters on the ground there. How much is this message, this fight over the vaccine and how it's being rolled out and the messaging around that, how much is that resonating with those voters?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think what Tam brings up is really important, which is that how much this virus, this pandemic has been politicized. Everything from whether you are going to wear a mask or not, who you're going to trust, whether you trust the news media, whether you trust public health officials, whether you trust the president. I think it's very dangerous when we're talking about a vaccine that could have a tremendous impact on the health of this country to put that also in the political context. It's difficult enough in everything that we know about getting people vaccinated to get the number of people we need to get vaccinated to stop this virus from spreading. So I don't think this is a particularly good idea. Again, it may be whatever the politics are. I think that this is very dangerous to start playing. This is really playing with people's health and safety. As for the messages that are going on, I do think that what seems pretty clear is the president is hoping that what voters are going to focus on is what's happening now. The trend line is going in the right direction on the economy. Sure, we don't have all the jobs back that we lost before the pandemic, but we're halfway there and we're going to keep getting better. No, we haven't gotten rid of the coronavirus, but we're kind of getting back some to normalcy. And again, hopefully there will be a vaccine soon enough. The Biden and Harris campaign, their message to voters is you can't forget what happened before. As Vice President, former Vice President Biden said today, it didn't have to be this bad. In other words, yeah, things are getting better, but we shouldn't have had to dig out this much in the way that we are. And second, that as the economy is improving, it's improving only for one group of people. If you're invested in the stock market, you're doing great. If you're in the high earner category and you can work from home, you're doing pretty well. If you're anybody else, you're still struggling.
Amy, let me stick with you on one related question, though, about some of the other groups they're speaking to. And this is picking up on the message we heard from the Harris family earlier, which is when we talk about the Midwestern states, which we know will be crucial in this election, we often talk about white voters and white communities. But there is a significant population of voters of color there. In particular, when you look at some of those states that back in 2016 that were decided by a less than 2% margin, six states in total, when you look at those states, Amy, could those voters, black voters in particular, could they make the difference in 2020?
Absolutely. I love that segment. And I think that Fred Harris hit it right on the nose when he said what's getting black voters out isn't necessarily Joe Biden. It's probably not going to be Joe Biden. He says it's Donald Trump. And he is the best motivator for every single constituency that Joe Biden needs. But I do think that, you know, the difference between now and say 2012, there was historic black turnout in 2012. We're unlikely, maybe we will see it, but to get to the numbers that we saw in 2012 for Joe Biden, I don't know if that's possible. In fact, more African-American voters voted as a percent of the electorate than white voters did. Their turnout was higher than white voters. I don't know that we're going to get to that point. But it's not necessary that Joe Biden does that because he's doing better with other groups than Obama did.
Tam, let me ask you about that message on the economy. We've heard that from Vice President Pence as well today. They're leaning into the idea that things are getting better and things will continue to get better if you just continue with this administration. When you're talking about an election that could come down to enthusiasm, who is motivated enough to show up and vote, is that message going to resonate? Is that going to mobilize people to get out?
You know, the real question about the economy, the president says that the economy is now in a super V. Like a V-shaped recovery. It's not clear that that is what is really happening or whether there was this bounce and now it's sort of plateauing. And so the thing that is going to be a real question leading into this is how do people feel? Absolutely, 8% unemployment is better than 10% unemployment. More people working is absolutely better. But as people go about their lives, are they going to see closed storefronts? Are they going to think about themselves or their friends who are not as doing as well as they were in February, for instance? And if President Trump is sort of focused on cheerleading the economy and saying it's all back, it's all better, is that going to hit voters? Are they going to feel like, well, he understands me, he hears me? Or are they going to feel like they've been skipped over? Former Vice President Joe Biden is putting a lot of emphasis on, you know, sort of we continue to feel the pain, you're feeling the pain. Is that going to be seen as negativity, or is that going to be seen as a reflection of reality? I think a lot of it depends on what people's reality feels like, you know, 60 days from now, or because voting is already starting very soon by mail in some places, how people are feeling, you know, 2 weeks from now.
Well, Tam, you mentioned voting already starting by mail. We should mention this week some of those first ballots by mail could start to come in. North Carolina was the first to start mailing them out on Friday. Tam, when you look at the misinformation that is swirling around this issue, some of the doubt that's already been seeded in the process, very briefly, I want to ask each of you, what do you think voters should be doing to prepare for this election in these last few crucial weeks? Tam, let's start with you.
Well, so President Trump last week spread a bit of misinformation about the process in North Carolina for getting those absentee ballots, making sure they count. But the underlying message of make sure that you get your ballot early, that you turn it in, that you checked with the registrar's office to make sure that it was actually received, that sort of message, voting advocates and others are saying that, you know, voting by mail is not the same as voting in person. It's not error proof. And people do need to sort of be proactive about the process. That's what voting advocates would say.
Amy, what about you? What's your message?
As someone who in school was often criticized for not reading the directions fully, I'm terrible about that. Read the directions. A lot of ballots that were thrown out in this primary were because people didn't follow the directions about, as Tam said, when to request them, when they need to be turned in. And finally, many of them are thrown out simply because you forgot to sign where you needed to sign on the envelope. So read the directions. All of these websites that the secretaries of states have put on, they're really good. Go to their websites, and if you still have a question, call them up.
I love that look into the life of a young Amy Walter there. That's Amy Walter and Tamara Keith joining us for Politics Monday. Thanks so much to both of you.
You're welcome.
Well, the United Kingdom is bracing for a new surge in COVID cases, partially locking down 20 towns to contain the spread. The city of Leicester is hoping to have some restrictions eased tomorrow after more than 2 months as Britain's most notorious COVID hotspot. Leicester's problems sprang from a district containing garment factories where some unscrupulous owners have been accused of running sweatshops during the pandemic. Special correspondent Malcolm Brabant has this report.
There's been outrage that conditions common in Asian slums have been found in this street in Leicester. Rudimentary screens have been erected to thwart prying eyes. These are some of the factories now under scrutiny after an undercover newspaper reporter was hired for $4.40 an hour, less than half Britain's minimum wage of $11. The overcrowded factory was operating illicitly during lockdown, and there was no social distancing.
The scandal is exploitation of labour, but there's also complicity as well, where workers will opt to be paid cash in hand so they can evade tax and national insurance contributions.
Raj Mann is a prominent member of Leicester's Sikh community. Sikhs and Muslims dominate the garment trade, employing about 10,000 people in Leicester.
It's endemic. So I don't accept the narrative from the authorities that this is a few factories.
We are talking about an industry that is employing largely African, Asian and minority ethnic communities. We are talking about British citizens.
Opposition Labour Party lawmaker Claudia Webber has been inundated with pleas for help from factory workers. They were too scared to talk publicly and accused some owners of forcing staff to work, even though they were sick with COVID.
It's modern slavery in the sense that people are being paid such low wages, are working in conditions which are unthinkable in today's age.
Over the past two decades, there have been several exposés of the Leicester garment trade, but the latest revelations stood out because the factories were portrayed as incubators for the virus.
COVID-19 has exposed Leicester's dirty little secret. The British equivalent of the FBI is now investigating allegations of slave labour across this city.
It's become a matter of life and death. I've had phone calls myself saying, you know, now I'm being compelled to work in these conditions.
North East Leicester, which contains the factories, was identified by health officials as a COVID hotspot.
An unintended consequence of the government's lockdown measures were that we shut down all non-essential retail, which include clothes shops. That forced people to buy off the internet, and it's the internet retailers who are sourcing from Leicester.
Lawmaker Andrew Bridgen represents a Leicestershire district for the Conservative Party.
How has this happened? It's a systemic failure of all the protection agencies, the police, the fire service, the local council, health and safety, factory inspectors.
The scandal has had severe consequences for Boohoo, previously Britain's most popular online clothes company. It took flak because the factory which hired the undercover reporter supplied stock to Nasty Gal, one of Boohoo's labels. At its peak last year, Boohoo was worth $6.5 billion, but its value plummeted by $1 billion in a single day. The driving forces behind Boohoo are Mahmoud Kamani and Carol Kane, who founded the company in 2006. They rejected an interview request but issued a statement promising an independent investigation into the supply chain. The statement said,
"The group will not tolerate any incidents of non-compliance with its code of conduct or any mistreatment of workers, and will not hesitate to terminate relationships with any supplier who does not comply."
In Parliament, the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, promised to crack down on what she called a modern scourge.
We have established a cross-government task force that will be on the ground in Leicester to absolutely ask the difficult questions of all institutions and organisations across Leicester with regard to this scourge that is taking place in the textile sector.
There's support across the aisle.
More inspectors, more resources, more energy put into these inspections.
There's no point just taking out a few factories, because all you'll do is create a pull factor for more people trafficking and illegal migration. So you've got to take down the whole organisation.
But in this deprived area of Leicester, veteran community worker Priya Thamotheram is sceptical about government promises because of previous failures to end malpractices.
Their reports were considered by a parliamentary select committee, but in terms of the actions that arose from that, pretty much zilch. It's very difficult to have any confidence in a top-down approach that seems to be adopted again.
Worldwide demand for cheap, fast fashion has contributed to the scandal.
I think this is cute.
Tiara Monet is an American fashion influencer with almost 1 million followers across social media.
Boohoo is notorious for having these last-minute 50% off sales, and that's usually when I do the most damage, because I'm like, oh, it was $20 and now I have to buy it.
It really is a time to make sure that we get some meaningful change.
Labour behind the label is a small non-profit striving to end garment workers' exploitation. Campaign manager Meg Lewis.
In the coming weeks and months, we're going to be putting pressure on the government and on big brands to make sure that this is a turning point, because we can't go back to the situation that we had before.
That means convincing artists like British pop band Little Mix to be more selective about the brands they promote. Here, they're touting the Pretty Little Thing collection, another Boohoo label.
Consumers need to be informed. They need to know where the garment is coming from and what the cost is in terms of exploitation. And they can vote with their pound and spend it on who they think is the most ethical clothes retailer.
Law agencies have conducted raids and sweeps throughout Leicester, but only a handful of factories have been punished for health and safety breaches. Activists fear that unscrupulous bosses are being tipped off in advance and are simply moving their operations to new premises, so the exploitation and risk of the virus spreading continue. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Malcolm Brabant in Leicester.
And finally tonight, like much of the world, superstar Gloria Estefan has been under quarantine at home in Vero Beach, Florida, with her husband Emilio. As part of our Beyond the Canvas series, I caught up with her to talk about life in isolation, wading into political debates, and why she decided to take an old hit song and turn it into a public service announcement to get more people to mask up.
You know, I wanted to use Get on Your Feet because in people's minds, it's an empowerment song. So I knew that it was, when they heard the music, it was going to make them happy. And I figure, you know, like a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. Put on your mask when you are buying groceries. My idea was to capture kids because there's a lot of fear. I know my own grandson literally said to my son, "Daddy, I don't want to die," when this was starting, because they hear and see everything. And I wanted to do a funny spin on a very serious subject matter. Really, the only tool we have as a public health tool is to wear masks. If we all would wear masks, we'd be much more protected.
Since you put that song out, masks themselves have become political, right? There's a huge debate over whether people should wear them, should be forced to wear them, where they can be required. What has that been like for you to watch as that debate unfolds?
Curious, because I think to myself, you know, how do we get to that point where something that is so simple, you know, to help to protect other people, because literally you're protecting other people more than yourself. And if everybody wears it, you know, it's like people ask me, how does Emilio's and my relationship work? And I say, well, he takes care of me and I take care of him. That means that we're both taken care of.
You and Emilio have both been hesitant to ever really talk too much about politics. Do you feel more strongly about some of those things than you did before?
Well, I feel strongly about it, but I'm still not going to share the views only because I have fans on both sides of the aisle. And it's kind of sad that there's only two sides of the aisle. I don't think that what my own personal political views, just because I'm a singer and somebody likes my music, that I should try to convince them otherwise. I think that everyone has to look at what's happening. We all have eyes. We all have ears. We all have brains. And I love this country, and I believe very much in its freedoms. And it pains me. It really hurts me to see what we're all going through here, because it's so unnecessary. I haven't been able to hug my family members for 5 months. I mean, it's like, it hurts. But we got to do whatever we got to do to make the world safer for our kids, for my grandson, you know. But I stayed away from politics in my song because I was a victim of politics. We lost our country, Cuba. You know, my dad gave up his life for both countries, for Cuba and for, you know, the U.S. when he went to Vietnam. He was in Bay of Pigs. He was in the U.S. Army. So to me, music was an escape from those kinds of things. That's why I've stayed away from, you know, politics in my music.
You really haven't hugged your family in 5 months. You seem like a hugger to me. That must be hard.
I am a hugger. I've hugged some trees. I've hugged trees. I've hugged my animals. I hugged my grandson for his birthday because I was able to convince my son, and his wife convinced him, to let me host something in my backyard, all of us with masks, only 8 of us. And I got my grandson a gigantic water slide. And as a kind of joke, but not really, I ordered hazmat suits at that because I was not going to let my son tell me that I could not hug my grandson.
You wore a hazmat suit to hug your grandson?
I did. And he hugged me I will never forget that hug. He wouldn't let go. He was holding on to me, like squeezing me. That hug lasted, it was the best thing the entire day. It was beautiful. I'm going to frame it and make it really big because tears are always on the edge during this time. But
we're all feeling that, right? Everyone's feeling that right now.
And you know what's funny about these kinds of things? I mean, you know, you've been in the business forever. There's something much more real, I think, that gets said and talked about in this. I could never be this close to you physically like we are right now.
No.
You're literally like 16 inches your face from mine. So you learn a lot more about people through these, you know, venues when you're speaking on a screen, because you're looking at their face the whole time. And you're at home in a setting. It's just a lot more, I think, conducive to actual real conversations.
Conversations Estefan says she'll continue to have, including through her music. Her latest album, Brazil 305, is out now. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz. As schools across the country reopen, parents and educators are debating the relative merits of at-home and in-class learning. But what do students think? Our Student Reporting Labs program teamed up with Detroit Public Television for a series of video diaries to document this very unusual school year as it unfolds. Here now are the students in their own words.
The start of school is going to be very chaotic, just because no one really knows what's going on.
Detroit Public Schools is having students take a survey about whether they want to take in-person learning or virtual learning. I chose online learning because I thought it was the safest.
I'm a little sad that we're going to start online, and I just think the thought of doing things online in my own room by myself, it's a very isolating feeling.
For me, I'm going to be going into school. I'm a little bit nervous, but I'm also excited to get back to school because it's been a really long time since I've actually physically been in school.
Everything is still online, but you can go to the school, which I need, because if I'm at home, I just feel like I'll go to sleep or I won't take it as seriously as I should.
When you go into a public building, you don't know where these people have been, you don't know what they've been touching, you don't know who they've been around, and there's just no way that you can say, yeah, I'm completely clean and free of the virus. So I think that going completely online is the best course of action right now, given the state of the pandemic.
It's going to be weird the way teachers have to teach, as some of their students are going to be online, some of them are going to be face-to-face.
But I am kind of sad and skeptical about how this is going to work. I'm not really going to get that senior experience, you know, the senior sunset, homecoming, our football games in the beginning of the year. I think it's going to be really hard for me.
What I'm most worried about isn't me. It's my younger siblings. I have a very hyperactive 8-year-old brother and a 10-year-old brother with learning disabilities. I know they probably won't be able to sit in front of a computer for 8 hours.
What are exams or just basic tests going to look like? Also the fact that I have yet to take the SAT.
I'm preparing for school by just keeping myself educated on the state of our country right now, which is very disappointing.
I've been riding my bike around the neighborhood a lot. It helps me clear my mind. Same thing with roller skating. Drawing and playing the guitar are two of my biggest stress relievers, especially if I'm feeling really just down and under the weather.
This year is just gonna be really different. It's gonna be a lot to get used to, but I think once we start and once the first week or two goes by, I think everybody will feel a lot more comfortable. And
I'll have more time during my break to do my homework, so I feel like that's a huge advantage.
I also don't have to eat school lunch every day anymore.
I'm gonna honestly just work as hard as I can online and look for upcoming colleges and, you know, just try my best, so.
We'll see how it goes. September 8th, I'm ready. I'm gonna treat it like any regular school day, and I hope it's the best year yet.
And on the PBS NewsHour online, some Labor Day reading from author Stephen Greenhouse. His book, Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future American Labor, is the September selection for the PBS NewsHour. New York Times Now Read This Book Club. You can check out his list of favorite books about America's labor movement and read more about his own reporting. That's on our website right now, pbs.org/newshour. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.